My name is Robert King Wilkerson. My present situation is Louisiana State Penitentiary, Angola, Louisiana. Upon entering Angola in May 1972, I was initially classified to the Prison Maximum Security Unit, CCR, a closed cell restricted. Well, for 27 years, I was kept in a 6x9x12-foot cell for 23 hours a day. In 1973, at the instigation of prison officials, I was falsely accused by inmates of having participated in the death of another inmate, tried, found guilty, and given a life sentence. Overwhelming evidence then and now shows that I am innocent. Undoubtedly, my involvement with the Black Panther movement was a factor in both my prison problem and my prison status.
Of all the organizations considered politically objectionable by the United States government in the 1960s and early 1970s, many believe that none were as targeted as the Black Panther Party by the FBI's secret national and illegal campaign of destruction known as COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO often worked to destroy such organizations from the inside out. Among their tactics was to use the courts to neutralize selective activists by obtaining false convictions against them. But while former FBI Director L. Patrick Gray and one-time director of Squad 47, a counterintelligence unit in New York City, were convicted of having conspired to injure and oppress the citizens of the United States because of their involvement with COINTELPRO, neither spent a day in jail. President Ronald Reagan pardoned them in 1981. Meanwhile, hundreds of former Black Panther Party members and other political prisoners remain in prison, forgotten by the public at large. Until recently, Geronimo G. Jaga was one of them. Former head of the Black Panther Party chapter in Los Angeles, he was charged in 1970 with a 1968 murder, even though he was 350 miles away at the time, attending a Black Panther Party meeting in Oakland. He always maintained his innocence and argued that the FBI's own files could vindicate him since he was under their surveillance. An FBI official testified on the stand that no such surveillance took place. Years later, after it was confirmed that the surveillance had indeed been conducted, the FBI claimed to have lost the logs. It wasn't until it was proven that the state's star witness against G. Jaga was an FBI informant, information that was not revealed to the jury at his trial, that his conviction was overturned and he was released. G. Jaga spent 27 years in prison. Prison activists have documented more than 100 former members of the Black Panther Party who are still in prison today, decades after COINTELPRO forces set them up. G. Jaga says there are hundreds more who are similarly framed in prison. These are the men who came of age behind bars. Once they became politically conscious and active, he says, COINTEL-like forces conspired to keep them there. In the turbulent early 70s, many of these prisoners became organizers of the Black Panther Party, and they became targets of prison authorities.
You become bullseyes of the targets of prison guards, you know. They target you, they set you up. They target you by setting you up and spreading rumors, gossip, putting false things in your files, getting you transferred, or anything that you could think of, because they do not want that prisoner to spread the word. It's as simple as that. In that era, the Black Panther Party was the main target, and anyone who would adhere to its philosophies or ideologies would be targeted also. The guys in prison who became politicized came at their own conclusion. These brothers and sisters arrive at these conclusions on their own without anyone forcing them. It's from within, from study and discussion with others and study. And once that happens, you witness some individuals that could rival any great person that we know on the streets but they don't have that recognition. They're like unsung heroes.
Among such political prisoners are three men in the Louisiana State Penitentiary who have been held in solitary confinement for 27 years. They are known as the Angola Three. Robert King Wilkerson, Herman Wallace, and Albert Woodfox became politically active in prison, where they were sent for unrelated armed robbery charges. Each became involved with the Black Panther Party, and now all three are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. Wilkerson, Wallace, and Woodfox say they were framed for killings that took place behind bars. They say trumped-up charges were leveled at them because of their activism. Each was convicted based on inmate testimony alone, testimony they say was paid for by prison authorities. This is the story of Robert King Wilkerson. Wilkerson was convicted of murdering another inmate in 1973, even though the man who actually committed the killing has always said he acted alone and in self-defense, even though several eyewitnesses testified that Wilkerson was innocent, even though the two inmates who testified against him have both recanted their testimony, swearing they lied to protect themselves. In spite of all this, and the fact there's not one shred of evidence against him, and now not one witness, Wilkerson cannot get judicial relief. Since the day he arrived in Angola, Wilkerson has been locked down 23 hours a day. He continued his activism unabated, fighting for better conditions and doing legal work for other inmates. Today, he is still fighting for justice in the courts. Speaking by phone from the prison, he says he is caught in a quagmire of legal motions and procedures before what is considered one of the most conservative groups of judges in the country, the Fifth Circuit.
I have a strong illusion, you know, that appealing to the sense of justice was one way of establishing and reversing this injustice. Even though I got off into law, knowing that I was innocent and believing that this could make a difference or would make a difference, and hopefully somewhere down the line it may still make a difference. I didn't realize at the time that the law itself was elusive.
Robert King Wilkerson has limited access to a phone, so he wrote his story. Portions of his letters are read by King Downing.
Wilkerson writes, "At a tender age when most teenagers are gearing up to graduate from high school and enter college, I was graduating from the State Industrial School for Colored Youths, or Scotlandville as some called it. Do not be deceived by these eye-catching names and phrases. They were merely euphemisms for juvenile prison. My promotion from youth prison to adult prison did not take long, and it was a relatively easy transition. All it took was for me to plead guilty to armed robbery. I was awarded 10 years at hard labor at Louisiana State Penitentiary, also called Angola. It was 1961. I had just turned 18 years old. Upon my release during the early months of 1970, I was picked up by the New Orleans police for fitting the description of one of two men who robbed the supermarket in the uptown area. Although the initial description of the robbers by the victim as indicated in the initial police report didn't remotely resemble me. Prior to my trial, I had reason to have high hopes that I would be going home soon, for the evidence they had against me did not warrant a conviction. But I had made the mistake of according the judicial system with more integrity than it actually had. I was convicted and sentenced to 35 years. My initial reaction was disbelief and disappointment, but this quickly changed to anger, then resolve. I made what some would consider an illegal determination with myself. I would escape. I stayed gone for 2 weeks before I was recaptured, and I received an additional 8 years. I was born on May 3, 1943. It can be very well said, however, that I was born sometime in the 1970s. For it was during this period that certain events happened around me that were to change me and my thought patterns forever, launching me into a new birth. Back in jail, I paid more attention to current events. The face of America was seemingly undergoing a major transformation where African Americans were concerned. I had begun to feel myself as being part of something whole that I had not been able to define before. Then one day, while watching television, a news announcer cut into the regular programming, reporting that a group of blacks, males and females, had barricaded themselves in an apartment complex and were shooting it out with police. This was unprecedented in the city of New Orleans, and as each scene unfolded, and with every word by the commentator, the kinship I felt with those inside the house grew. I was later to learn that the group calling itself the NCCF, or the National Committee to Combat Fascism, were actually members of the Black Panther Party. Miraculously, they all survived, and they were detained in the New Orleans Parish Prison where I was. Though the officials tried to keep those brothers and sisters separate from the other prisoners, their attempts failed. We found ways to communicate and exchange literature. Though Malcolm X and others had said much of the same thing that the Panthers were saying, I did not hear it until the Panthers said it. So I can say candidly that this period was my period of hearing and seeing. Being unable to articulate my true feelings at the time, the party spoke the words for me. Unable to define myself at the time, the party defined me. We began holding political education classes and staged various protests, including a hunger strike that 700 prisoners participated in. Those accused of organizing the hunger strike were sent to the parish prison annex. Needless to say, we continued to educate ourselves to party principles, and we continued resisting. We were also able to maintain communications with the brothers at the prison. We sent literature, we received literature.
We can jump together. We can jump together and eat another. I ain't joking. We can jump together.
Then outline the plight, the historical plight of Black people as a whole in America in relationship to their condition, the past and at the time present condition inside the society, political oppression, systemic oppression as a whole. There was a 10-point program that they gave, which really was arresting, you know, and I think one of the points was we want freedom, we want power to determine our own destiny, and that stuck with me greatly.
By the time Wilkerson was transferred to Angola from the parish prison, he was an official member of the Black Panther Party. When he arrived in Angola, which was known as the most repressive and bloodiest prison in the country, his record of militancy arrived with him.
The prison was in an uproar. Mass lockups and repression of prisoners by prison officials was the order of the day. A young prison guard had been found slain in one of the main prison dormitories before I arrived. Although I was not here at the time of the guard's death, I didn't escape the unchecked reprisals by the keepers upon the kept. Along with three other brothers, I was taken from the admitting unit and transported to the main prison dungeon. While there, I witnessed more severe repression, especially against those who were scooped en masse from the main prison and placed in isolation for the investigation in the death of the guard. Late into the night, or in the wee hours of the morning, men were taken from these cells and forced to run the catwalk to another cell block while guards lined up alongside wielding bats, clubs, and other batons. Inmates were stripped of all clothing, their heads were shaved, and they were kept in bare, empty cells. White prisoners were spared. None were beaten or placed in lockdown or investigated as suspects into the death of the guard. The beatings and intimidation of Black prisoners went on for days.
Accused of playing lawyer, Wilkerson was thrown into the notorious punishment dorm known as the Red Hat. The facility, which held the electric chair, also held small empty cells where Wilkerson says prisoners were confined for days at a time at the whim of security personnel. When federal courts got involved in running the prison because of its brutality, the Red Hat was demolished.
Cells must have been about maybe 2.5, 3 feet wide. You had a slab, a thick slab of concrete. You had a sink, you had a toilet, you had a little window. You got no blankets, mattress, anything like that. Food, you was on a diet during that time. And then when it was cold, because you didn't get blankets, you had a single jumpsuit on, no underclothes and no clothes and no mattress. And I think at nighttime, if it wasn't summertime, at nighttime you got cold. I think we did about 12, 13, maybe 14 days in the Red Hat. I know I had lost an extreme amount of weight.
In state prison. Bad on me. And you know it was shame on everybody else.
From there, Wilkerson was sent to CCR, or Closed Cell Restricted, where he would be locked down 23 hours a day. At the time, he was serving a sentence for armed robbery. In his mind, his classification to solitary confinement was only because of his Black Panther Party affiliation. One year, a correction officer informed him he had been locked down initially because he was being investigated for the killing of a white security guard in 1972, a killing that took place before he arrived at Angola. He says his attempts to get an explanation from prison officials over the years have been futile. Authorities at Angola declined to comment for this story.
On June 10, 1973, a fight erupted between two inmates, Grady Brewer and August Kelly. And when it was over, Kelly died as a result of multiple stab wounds. There was a blanket indictment of 11 of the 14 inmates who resided on the tier, myself included. Further investigation narrowed the indictment down to two prisoners, myself and Grady Brewer. Neither Grady nor I were disturbed by this turn of events. We were both eager to go to trial. He felt that no reasonable court, upon hearing the facts, would find him guilty of murder, knowing that he had only acted in self-defense. And I was eager because I dared to believe that the state could not possibly bring me to trial and find me guilty since there were so many witnesses. The trial began on October 10, 1973. The court ruled that we would be tried jointly and that we would be handcuffed behind our backs with tape over our mouths and shackles on our legs. Gagged and bound throughout jury selection and throughout the trial, neither of us could take the stand in our own defense or even communicate with our lawyer. In 1987, John Riley, the sole inmate who testified against me in my second trial, made it known to me through another inmate that he wanted to set the record straight. He wanted it to be known that he had lied during my trials and that he did not witness the incident. Shortly thereafter, I received his notarized affidavit stating that he perjured himself at both my trials.
In 1987, one of the inmates who testified against him, John Riley, contacted Wilkerson and told him he wanted to set the record straight. He swore on an affidavit that he had in fact lied on the stand, that he did not witness the killing because he was in the shower. The prison's own records also show that Riley was in the shower. Wilkerson also received another affidavit signed by the second inmate who testified against him at his first trial. Charles Lawrence swore that at the time of the killing, he had 8 months remaining on his sentence, and he was told by prison security officials that if he did not testify against Wilkerson, that he would not be released, that he would instead be tried for the killing, and that he would be given the death sentence. Attorney Christopher Aberle has been seeking justice for Wilkerson for the past 7 years.
He was tried in a prison jumpsuit in front of an all-male jury. In very rural Louisiana, of course it's the mid-70s. He was handcuffed, his legs were shackled. Even more than being an all-male jury in rural Louisiana, the only reason for most people's existence in this part of Louisiana is Angola itself. Angola is way out in the country next to the Mississippi River, and there's a small community there, and virtually everyone in that community has a direct family member working for the prison. It is from these people that you get the jury pool who are going to sit in judgment of an Angola inmate. I sensed that there was not much concern whether they got it right or not for a black man in the mid-70s in a largely white community. I won't say there were no blacks on the jury. I believe there may have been one. But not only was this a black man on trial, he was already a convict.
Aberle says the jurors ignored all the evidence that supported Wilkerson's innocence, not only the testimony by the man who killed the deceased, but also testimony from the coroner stating the stab wounds were made by one knife. 7 knives were recovered, only one had blood on it. None of the knives were checked for fingerprints. And he says the trial was fraught with constitutional violations. violations which Aberle says appeals courts are simply brushing aside. For example, Wilkerson's defense counsel was not allowed to cross-examine the state's only witness against him about a deal he made with authorities. His defense was ineffective for failing to call a prison guard to the stand who testified favorably for Wilkerson at his first trial, and Wilkerson was forced to stand trial handcuffed and shackled and surrounded by an army of armed guards. In fact, Aberle says the courts continue to seize on anything to avoid reversing Wilkerson's conviction. At one point, Wilkerson was granted post-conviction relief. After a series of complicated motions and procedures by the courts, it was taken away. Among the Fifth Circuit's rulings is one that has outraged those familiar with Wilkerson's case. The judges ruled that the constitutional issues raised by Wilkerson are nothing more than harmless errors. And they ruled the evidence against Wilkerson is overwhelming.
Never in my life have I seen any court in any state, any federal court, evidence to be overwhelming when the evidence is a single eyewitness with no physical corroborating evidence. What you're dealing with is a credibility decision that the jury has to make, and that can be colored by anything. And as a consequence, courts simply do not hold that as overwhelming. But in this case, they did.
My own experience with the judicial system has taught me that courts and prosecutors are not interested in dispensing true justice. That in fact, the truth and the innocent factor are far removed from the court's basic foundation. It was only after many, many years of hard-earned first-hand experience that this truth about the court's function gradually opened up to me. When the full impact hit me, I was shocked. I had always believed that whatever was termed legal should automatically be perceived as being right, moral, that when it was legal, it was akin to sacredness and holiness. But my own dealings with legality have taught me otherwise. Legality and morality aren't synonymous. Despite these observations, my quest for justice within the courts goes on. For it was there, in the courts, that the key to the lock which holds me was manufactured. And it is there, in the courts, that the key to open the lock will be manufactured.
Wilkerson's case is now before the Fifth Circuit again. If he is denied, he plans to take his case to the Supreme Court. But whether or not it will even be considered is unknown. The Supreme Court receives thousands of cases a year and only reviews a handful. In the meantime, Aberle has taken an unorthodox step and contacted the district attorney where Wilkerson was tried in 1975. He has asked him to reopen the case and drop the charges, but has received no response. If it were not for this murder conviction, Wilkerson would have been free to leave Angola in 1986. Wilkerson says it's his passion and fervor that have carried him this far and that will enable him to continue.
I may not have 27 more years, but the time which I do have, I will exhibit no less passion for justice and freedom than I've done for the past 27 years. In fact, I will intensify this passion. In the meantime, the struggle continues.
Breaking the Chains, the story of Robert King Wilkerson, was produced by Leslie George, engineered and mixed by Dred Scott Keys, with special thanks to King Downing, Malik Rahim, Anita Yesho, and WBAI in New York. I'm Leslie George.
Yeah.